Conference.
And when were you born?
December, in La Grande Fruitvale, about a mile north of the Riverside Park.
Were you born in the hospital or at home?
I'm sure I was at home. I remember my brother talking about a little excitement around there that night.
And what type of story does your brother tell?
Well, I guess probably it was, of course, he was 5 years older than I, and he didn't know what was going on, excepting that there was lots of excitement, I guess, so that's kind of the way it was.
And what were your parents' names?
Well, my father was William Martin Hawkins. Mother was Annetta Albertson Hawkins.
And were they natives to La Grande, or did they move from...
No, mother was a native of Ogden, Utah, and dad was a native of Aramo, Idaho.
And what brought them to La Grande?
Well, they were married in 1915, but dad moved here in 1902. And his mother had already moved here. Her daughter, Mrs. Claude Wright, not Mrs. Claude Wright, Mrs. Claude Wright's mother, anyway, was here, and he came, I guess, to help them, and they had a little place out where I was born in north of La Grande, and that was...
Was your father a farmer?
He was a farmer before he came here. He farmed for a while in this small area, 23 acres out there. And then he got a job for the Union Pacific Railroad, and he worked there for 37 years as a boilermaker.
Oh, wow. And your mother, was she a homemaker?
She was a homemaker here. She was a school teacher in Utah. And they were both fairly well and long in years before they got married. Mother was 38 and dad was 40. First marriage for both. So that probably accounts for some of the excitement when I was
born. Probably so. So what was your home like that you grew up in? Was there running water?
No. It was in... Outside of La Grande, there was a little spring about 150 feet from the house, and it was carried in with buckets. I don't remember that, however. I was 2 years old when I moved away from there out to this road. We moved down here on Hawkins Road at that time, and we didn't have electricity or running water there either. So it was pretty primitive, I guess, when you look back on it.
So was it one bath a week, two baths a week?
Probably one or two, yes. In a number three tub set on the kitchen stove.
You took turns, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess that was. It just seemed like that was the natural way to do it at that time. I didn't know anything other.
Anything different?
And we didn't have electricity out here until 1946, after I got, well, I guess during the war my folks got it. I was in the Navy, and they got electricity here.
Now, where did you attend school at?
In Union.
And you went through the high school there?
Yes.
Did you play any sports?
Track, and a year or two of football. Nothing spectacular in either case. We milked cows out here, had a few cows, sold cream, and it seemed like, well, dad was working nights at the railroad in order to work days here and pay for the place during a depression, and it didn't seem like I had time, I guess, or something. We rode the bus after about 1937. Before that, we rode to the neighbor's school and, you know, through high school.
What do you remember most about the Depression? How did it affect your family?
about the Depression? Well, it seemed that I was young, and I guess we didn't know much different. We always had plenty to eat, but I'm sure there were a lot of days when my folks had a lot of worry on the deaths that was owed on this farm out here. I can remember Dad used to try to get night work at the railroad, 3:30 to 11:30, and then he'd get up about 7 in the morning and start farming until time to go back to work at 3:30. And that was the way it went all the way through.
And are your parents buried around here then?
Yes, they're in the Grand.
At the Grand Cemetery? So after high school, what did you do?
Joined the Navy. Well, right after I got out of high school, a day after I got out of high school, another fellow and I took off in a car and we went touring down through Utah and California and Idaho and California. And I had a number of jobs there, some of them kind of interesting. I got a job cooking in a dining car.
Oh, wow.
it was dishwashing. They called it a fourth cook, but it was a dishwasher. We cooked a little bit, but very little. And it was an experience. In those times, they hadn't hired white people. They had colored cooks all the time. Well, in about 1940, they decided they were not going to hire colored cooks, and they were going to hire white people from then on. Well, there was resentment among the coloreds. Well, they had chef and second cook and third cook, and I was the dishwasher, the white, and the only white in the kitchen. So I know exactly what there was quite a bit of resentment at that time.
Sure.
I only worked at that for about 3 months, and we just started out to have fun and see what the world looked like when they got out of high school. I say 3 months. No, I didn't work that long. It was probably closer to 2 months. And then I got a job, I guess going door to door selling silverware and wristwatches for the Anderson Jewelry Company in Ogden. And went out and worked in the hayfield and thin beets, and we'd get a few dollars and take off. And we had a 1937 Ford, another fellow and I. And I think if I remember right, we left home with about $35 a piece, and we were gone for, we'd come back in October, it was probably 4 or 5 months. And we were broke when we got back, of course. But we just worked and get a few dollars. And it was before the war. There was quite a bit of work around at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down into Los Angeles. And probably a few gray hairs came to my folks.
While you were gone. Now, when did you join? Did you join the Army then?
Joined the Navy.
The Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, I wasn't drafted. I came back from this trip and I got a job as a boilermaker apprentice here in La Grande in the Union Pacific Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there for, let's see, that was in 1941. I worked there for about a year and a half, and of course in December of 1941 the war started.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there until September, and then I enlisted. I wasn't drafted. I just wanted to go. And I guess I could have got deferred. A lot of the fellows that worked there did. It was a job that the boss said you could get you deferred. And then, of course, I was helping the farm here, too. But at that time, I just wanted to go. So that was, we went down to Corpus Christi, Texas to serve boot camp, and that was quite an experience. Everything was full at that time. We started down in a troop train. We enlisted in Portland, There was about 400 of us at the time, went at the same time. And we were supposed to start for Chicago. Well, we got out somewhere in Kansas, and they said Chicago was full of the boot camp. So then we were headed back for San Diego. And this was just a troop train with mm-hmm. nothing but troops on it. And they headed us back for San Diego for about a day, and then they found out that was full.
No.
So there was a new base just opening up in Corpus Christi, Texas. So they headed us back down there. And of course, it was just barracks, and we spent most of our boot camp planting lawn around the barracks. And that was about the extent of that. Well, I was in Corpus Christi then after I got out of boot camp. It was a Naval Air Training Station, is what it was. But I wanted to get sea duty because at that time there was lots of ships that had boiler steam. But it just seemed like it just never worked out that way. They just put you wherever you happen to be when the time comes. And I was in Corpus Christi for about a year, 11 months I think, a little over a year. And then I got transferred to California to shipped out on a transport ship and went to Australia. And that was in 41, no, yeah, that was in September of 1941. And we went up to Cairns. We thought we were headed for New Guinea. That was the direction we were going. And if this again was a troop transport, we weren't assigned to the ship's company or anything. But we got up at Cairns, Australia, and they went to turn the ship around. Well, the tide is real high there. And it was a ship about probably 300 feet long. It was a bay and a kind of a river and a bay combined. Well, the tide went out and the ship got stuck crossways.
Oh, no.
So the captain unloaded everybody. I mean, they wanted to get the ship lightened up as soon as they could. Well, we hiked off down through the woods there to a racetrack, I guess it was, an old Australian racetrack, and spent the night. Well, in the meantime, they got our orders straightened out, and there was a new base going in at Mackay, and that's where 12 of us got assigned to that. And so we caught a train back then to Mackay. But that was just kind of the way it was mm-hmm. all the way through. I never got much sea duty, actually. I wanted it, but I never did get it. Then we got back to Brisbane. And was there for a while. Got assigned to Naval Air Transport, which was the old Pan-American seaplanes, flying boats. And that's where I spent most of my time overseas, in the islands. We went off from there. I had time in Brisbane, Australia with them, and then we went to Kwajalein. And from there, back to Hawaii, and from there back to California, outside of San Francisco there.
So when did you end up back in La Grande, after the war?
Yes, I was discharged in 1946. I was a storekeeper, and they kept them in later, longer, to kind of take care of mm-hmm. Getting rid of things. And I got out about February of 1946, and came home, went back to railroading, boilermen, serving my apprenticeship. And that was in February, and then in, well, it was a talk show dance in Union. I went to a dance over there, and I met Hazel. And that was, I had never met her before. Well, that was in June, prior to the Eastern Oregon Stock Show. And in October, we were married. And that, by the way, is 59 years ago, I think.
Wow. That's a long time. Tell me about your boiler apprenticeship.
Well, of course, all at that time, all the locomotives were steam. And there was a lot of repair to them, especially on these mountains. They have broken staples, and they run with a pretty high pressure steam. And boiler making was quite common in those days. However, when the diesel locomotives came in, it did away with boiler making. And that, of course, I served that apprenticeship for before the war and after the war. I had about 3.5 years in, and I was set up as a boiler maker there for a while. However, I started out at 32 cents an hour. Boiler making. But that was about half, or about a third of what a regular boiler maker was getting. To go back a little bit, talk about wages in boiler making. My father was a boiler maker, and I remember probably 1940. Well, I think it was before I went in the Navy, but probably about when I was in high school, they got a raise. And he was just as proud as could be. Of course, he still had a lot of debt on this farm. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a lot of debt. He came home one time, and I remember it so well. He was just so happy. He said, "We got a raise." He says, "I'm getting 60 cents an hour." He said, "Just think of that." He said, "That's a penny a minute." He says, "Nobody's worth a penny a minute."
Oh, that's funny.
But anyway, after I served this apprenticeship, and the diesel started coming in about that time, and boilers went out. Well, I was set up for a boiler maker for a short time, and then I didn't have my apprenticeship filled, so when they started laying off boiler makers, I had to go back and finish that apprenticeship. And I served the tail end of my apprenticeship cutting up these steam locomotives for our scrap.
Oh, wow.
So that was about the end of my boiler making career, and that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because I got out and went to work then for a fellow called Paul Bunyan. Company, Van LeGrand. He made logging trailers. And I was welding and working in there for several years after we got married. And that kind of slowed down, and then I went to work Consolidated, which Havel was also working there in the meantime. Excuse me.
Now, they were a shipping company, is that right?
Well, yes, it was a freight company.
Hauling
freight. Well, at that time, they were one of the bigger freight between Portland and Seattle and Chicago, I think. And they dropped off freight at all the small towns, and I was just working here in LeGrand delivering freight from when they dropped it off to the different stores.
And then when did you start farming then?
Well, after we got married in October, and the little place came up for sale in February of 47, outside of the Grand there, Fruitdale. And we got an apartment there in the Grand when we got married. And in about February of 47, this place came up for sale out pretty close to where I was born out there, and we bought it. 10 acres and a little house. It wasn't modern.
So no running water?
Huh?
No running water?
It didn't have running water. Cold water. Just cold. No
hot?
No hot water.
And electricity?
had an oil stove for heat. Just three rooms, one right behind the other one. And this was, at that time, there was lots of people coming out of the service, and they were looking for small, anything to live in. I mean, we felt real fortunate to get it. I got a GI loan, and it was $4,700 for 10 acres in the house. But, there again, we were still working for less than a dollar an hour, so quite a bit less than when I got, at that time, I think, well, when I went to this Paul Bunyan company first, I think the wage then was a dollar an hour. And I started working, running a record. And at nights, I'd get $2 an hour for working at nights, which I thought was just great. But that's the way it went on through there. And of course, Havel at that time was working for Consolidated. I quit then and went to work for Paul Bunyan. Excuse me, I went to work for Paul Bunyan, and then I went to work for Consolidated. But I quit. Of course, the railroad laid off all the boilermakers, and that was.
So when did you start farming full time?
Well, in 1950, I was still working for Paul Bunyan Company, and I'd made arrangements to rent a place from my father. He had the one I was born on around Fruitvale was 23 acres, and I was going to rent that and still work. And in July, he had 160 here on Hawkins Road, and he fell over dead with a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
So I decided that was the time I had to start farming. Mother was still living here, and they had a place in town, but she was reluctant to move into town until that time. And after he died, I started farming full time then. But in order to make ends meet, I would work in the winter time. I went back to work for the railroad as a laborer, wiping grease off the diesel locomotives and cleaning diesel, fueling. Not only that, I delivered oil around town for a year or two, too, in the winter time when I wasn't farming. For Burley Hyde and Mobile Oil up there.
So you're delivering oil for homes for heat or
home heating? Yes.
What do you farm? Because you still farm, correct?
Oh yes.
And what did you start out farming in the beginning?
Start out? Well, I always liked cattle, which was a very small part of it. And we had wheat, and pretty much that was it at that time. It was just wheat and cattle. Then from time to time, we'd pick up another piece of ground, and we went in later on to hay, and we raised milk for a while. And
when you started, because with wheat, what type of wheat? Was it always the same kind of wheat that you planted?
Well, mostly soft white wheat was about all we raised here at that time. We summer fall about half and try to recrop once in a while, but it was the wheat we had at that time and fertilizer and was not used very much at that time. Summer following was pretty well known as a custom way of doing things.
And who did you sell the wheat to?
Well, Pioneer Flouring Mill usually took care of it, and they would sell it to Portland. They'd ship it to Portland. Of course, it would go overseas or in the channels, wherever it happened to go. But you just sell the wheat to the mill, and then they would in turn sell it to whoever wanted it.
Now, did the price of wheat fluctuate every year, or did it pretty much stay even?
It fluctuated, yes. still is. But, I think probably about $1.10 was after World War II was about what it ran, as I remember. And it was up to $1.25 and back down. And then, of course, as time went on, it raised a little bit. And not as much as a lot of other things did in proportion, though. It still has it, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you first started planting wheat, did you use... How was the planting done? Did you plow with horses?
Not after I started farming full time, but when I was a kid, we farmed with horses out there. I started out when I was probably 10 or 12 years old mowing with a team of horses, and then later on, we'd bind, and my dad was still working nights at the railroad, mm-hmm. so we had a little binder and three horse.
Now, what's binding?
Well, that would put the wheat in bundles.
Okay.
And then the bundles would be shocked, and about 12 or 15 or whatever it was. And then the thrashing machine would come later on, and they'd fix the bundles on a wagon, take them to the thrashing machine, and thrash it. Then they had to pick the wheat up in sacks, load it on wagons, and haul it to Union or wherever the mill was. And it was all hand labor, all hard hand labor. When they first got combines, they'd have a sack sawer up on top, and they would get five sacks, which would weigh about 130 pounds or 40 pounds a piece. They'd drop five of them off out in the stubble, and then go on until you get five more and drop it. Well, then people had to come around, and there was usually just one man doing that. They'd pick those sacks up and put them on a wagon and haul them to Union. And you'd make maybe two loads a day from here. Lots of times only one. But that was hard labor. I wasn't in on any of that. I was too young for that, I'm glad to say.
And when they did was it by the weight of the wheat? Is that how prices were determined, how much the wheat weighed, or?
Well, wheat, yes, in a way, it was sold by the bushel.
Okay.
And number one wheat had to be 60 pounds to the bushel. And that would be your bushel price. If it had something wrong, it was shriveled or anything like mm-hmm. that, it would weigh less than 60 pounds, so you'd get docked accordingly. That was usually the way it was sold. And barley was raised here too quite a bit in those days, and oats.
When the combines came into the picture, was there less farming accidents, you think, or did it cause more accidents, or just different types?
Accidents?
Did you have any accidents farming?
Well, I suppose they did. I mean, yeah, I'm sure they had accidents, but I don't remember of anything serious at that time. The worst I ever had is after I started farming, I had a fellow break a leg, and that was kind of nasty. Of course, I had a kind of a serious accident later on when I was here about 10 years ago.
What was that?
Well, we were moving cattle down here. I bought a horse at the sale. It was just a half-broke colt. And, of course, I was 70 at that time. And we were moving cattle, and there was an old cow that had a calf right under this big spreading willow tree. And she was kind of snorty. And this colt was green as could be. And I was trying to get him to go in there. Well, about the time I got partway under this tree, the old cow took after this colt and goosed him in the ribs, and he started bucking. My dog took after the cow, and then, anyway, that horse got me on the saddle horn, and I couldn't fall off, I couldn't do anything, and he just pounded the dickens out of me. And I finally got off out there, and I thought, well, I knew I was hurt some, but I thought, half a day in the easy chair and take care of it. The other fellows took the horse and I took the pickup on down and headed the cattle the right way and drove it on and on out here. And when I got out of the pickup, well, I felt kind of loose in the middle. Felt a little bit shaky, and well, real shaky, in fact. Hazel looked out the window and I went over and sit down on the pump steps there. I told her I was going to come in and rest for a while. And she said, no, you're going to the hospital. So anyway, I went to the hospital. And it was just split my pelvis. It was the way it had. And anyway, they had me here for a while, opened me up. Well, it was bruised up so bad they couldn't put a plate in, so then they sent me to Boise. And make a long story short, I had pins and rebar pulling me together. I had to lay on my back. I couldn't turn my side for 64 days in the hospital. And that was the worst accident. That was my own fault. And after I was in the hospital back up here recuperating, my fellow came in and talked to me and he said, well, he said, it kind of sounded like that colt was acting his age and you weren't. And I think that just about
summed it up, huh?
That summed it up in a nutshell.
So how many head of cattle did you have?
Well, we used to run cattle that rented from Boise Cascade up here and also had a government permit to run cattle, and we bought it from the Davis Cattle Company, which we eventually, well, they were retiring and we got their permits, bought their permits by buying cattle and transferring. And then we ran cattle up that way for about 18 years in the hills and winter them down here in the valley and where we live now.
Now who did you sell them to then when you were...
Who did we sell them?
Did you sell them for meat then?
Well, we sell the calves through the auction sale here.
Mm-hmm.
And or to a private buyer, we did that several times. But that was an interesting deal. In the hills, you were riding quite a bit. And you'd take them up in May, and you wouldn't see them a lot of times, so a lot of them until October when they start coming down. They would naturally kind of come by themselves, mm-hmm. most of them, but there was always lots of hard, cold days riding looking for the last few up in the hills in the snow and a few old bulls or something and get off in the brush patch and didn't want to come home. But it was interesting, and the kids were young when we started out. It was a good experience for them. They both really liked it. And it was an experience that every kid should have, really.
So did the price of cattle fluctuate a lot over the years?
Oh, yes. Yes, it has. I sold calves, well, for 17 cents a pound for heifers. I think it was about 19 for the steers one year. And it fluctuated right on up. Up and down, of course, but now they're about $1.30, $1.35 for the steers and $1.30 for the heifers and everything, which is sure a lot of difference. We fatten cattle there for a while. We bring the calves in and then put them in a feedlot and feed them grain for about 120 days, all the grain they could eat, and then sell them as fat cattle, and they'd be butchered back at the time. Now, of course, we just sell wiener calves, and they take them to feedlots. It's changed in those days. You couldn't probably find a place now to sell a fat that calf steer without taking a dock because there's the big, huge feedlots. They have thousands of head now, where we used to have 75 or 100 and fat them out and sell them to the same place.
Tell me about farming. You said you farmed mint. You farmed mint. Is that correct?
Peppermint.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about that.
Well, they're still doing a lot of it here in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real interesting crop. It's an expensive crop to grow. You have to fertilize it real regular. Lots of water. Probably irrigate it about once a week and fertilize it about three times during the summer. And it takes quite a bit of hand labor, usually Mexicans, to weed it, hand weed it sometimes. And of course they've got lots of sprays too that will take care of that. Excuse me. The reason we don't grow peppermint now, I didn't ever buy the machinery, I just hired people who had the machinery to custom farm it.
It took special machinery then?
Oh yes, it takes, you have to have a still and boil the peppermint to get the oil out of it. That's what they want.
Okay, so after the crop is done, you have to...
Yeah, they take the crop up green,
okay,
run it through a still, and heat it with steam, and the steam and the water comes out. Well, the water will sink and the oil will come to the top, and it's quite a process. But in the last few years that we raised it, they started raising peppermint in India and China with hand labor that's not cheaper than this. So it got down to that there was a surplus of American mint oil, and it was just a kind of a toss-up as to whether it was worth it. And I didn't really have an awful lot of machinery to worry about, or I didn't have a still, so we just dropped it and started going back to the wheat and hay and the cattle.
How much hay did you harvest every year?
Well, we raised quite a bit there. For a while, we raised probably 2,500 acres of alfalfa, which would go anywhere 3 to 4 tons per acre. And a lot of that was sold overseas.
Now, what's alfalfa used for?
For feeding cattle.
Okay.
Of course, Japan buys a lot of alfalfa in this country. They would compress the bales and compress them even more than the baler, and then they'd ship them overseas. And they're still doing a lot of that. They're pretty particular. They got to have it just about right in order to do it. And then there's lots of people that run cattle in the hills, and they buy hay. They don't have the land to put up the hay.
Now, what is the process for haying? I mean, walk me through the process of when you start to the finish.
Well, of course, you have to plant them first.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get much of a crop the first year. The second year, and for about the next 3 or 4, you get good crops. It has to be swathed, and now they put it up in big bales that weigh probably 1,200 pounds each. It used to be small bales. And in those days, you'd hire kids to pick the small bales up and take them and stack them. But that's kind of a thing of the past. Now the big bales, they do it all with machinery. If they do a lot of it, if they do ship it to Japan and Korea, they cut the big bales back down and rebale them to small bales again. But not here at the place. They take it from their shipping point.
What kind of machinery is used now for baling?
Well, they use swathers.
And what's a swather?
It cuts the alfalfa or the hay, runs it into a windrow, and most of them have a set of rolls that crushes the stem to make it dry quicker.
Okay.
Then it has to be left out in hopefully dry weather. If it rains, it cuts the quality of it real fast. And it has to dry until it's down to about 12%. And then they bale it and stack it. And then, of course, it's ready to keep for the winter or ship and whatever the case might be.
Do you do much haying anymore, or are you just mostly wheat?
Well, we still raise quite a little bit of hay. I raise enough for our own use. We still run about 120 cows, and which takes about 300 tons of hay a year. Then I have hay to sell to people who have an extra. We usually have 1,000, 1,500 tons to sell.
Keeps you busy.
Hmm?
So it keeps you busy.
Well, yes, of course, there again, in the last few years, I've been hiring a lot of that work done with people who have the machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And we just custom work it and then we sell it or feed it ourselves or whatever.
What is your favorite aspect of farming?
The future, you mean?
What's your favorite aspect of it, of farming?
Oh. Well, I always did like cattle, but they go in awful good with wheat because you can turn them out after you harvest the wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And they clean up, and we have quite a few miles of creek bank and one thing or another that would grow weeds and grass, and you can't get on it to farm it with machinery. And so I have that fence pretty well so that the cattle can clean the dikes, and we have to put dikes up to keep high water from flooding. It's pretty regular out there. I always did like the cattle pretty much, but then a combination of the two works pretty good. Weaving cattle together and take.
How has the effects of spraying, you know, chemicals and that type of stuff, how has that affected the world of farming?
Well, it's gone from, you might say, none when I was a kid to a terrific amount of it now.
Mm-hmm.
You depend on chemicals even to do your summer following, a lot of people are. You just spray the Roundup to take care of the weeds, and you spray 2,4-D to take the broadleaf weeds out of the wheat. And of course with mint, why, they have sprays that they can take broadleafs out of broadleaf, and then it doesn't hurt the mint, and take the weeds and stuff out of it that way. It's amazing the amount of things they can do with spray now. Whether it's altogether good or bad, I still have a few doubts about some of it. It's getting kind of spooky,
mm-hmm.
the things they can do with it. They have a chemical that they can spray on wheat to take the broadleaf weeds out of it. It works real good. But if you have soil that's alkaline, it stays in the ground and it keeps hurting this same place where you put it on for a number of years. And then if it's a neutral soil, it doesn't seem to hurt it. But with any alkali in it, that will stay there, and broadleafs for years after will come up, they'll sprout, but then they die as soon as they get out of the ground.
So it can affect the soil then for years to come.
Mm-hmm. It does.
What major changes have taken place in agriculture in the Grand Ronde Valley in your time of farming?
Major changes? Oh, golly. Well, when before I was remember, there was Amalgamated Sugar
mm-hmm.
here, and they raised sugar beets here with horses, and the farmers would take them in. They had a little beet factory in La Grande. But then they went clear out of Sugar Beets, and from the time, from the 1920s, up until 10 years ago, they never raised Sugar Beets. Now they're coming back and raising them again. They're raising quite a few here now. Mint was never heard of when I was young. It was just strictly wheat, oats, and barley, and alfalfa hay, and cattle. But farms were small. There used to be several houses on this road, and everybody had a few milk cows. They'd milk them, most of them by hand, sell cream. There was a cream truck come down and maybe deliver a pickup about twice a week. They'd pick up the cream. And they had a creamery in Union. They made butter and cheese and everything. And of course they had one in the town too. But now nobody sells cream. You couldn't sell a can of cream if you had it. I mean, they just don't do it. No place to sell it. Hogs are another thing. Everybody used to have a few hogs, and they could sell them pretty easy. Now, about the only buyer there is in Klamath Falls, and that's a Japanese-owned company, I understand. And so hogs are pretty much a thing of the past. There's a few still raised here, but very small numbers in comparison to what they used to. Beef cattle seem to be more than there used to be. Dairy in this valley is not. There isn't even one dairy here in this area. There is some up in Baker County, but that's grade A, and of course they are inspected a lot more than the old tile cream. I mean, they didn't have inspectors. You'd sell cream and they'd make butter out of it. They'd pasteurize it and make butter. Now, of course, the dairy has to be up to real high standards in order to sell whole milk and keep it that way. They have inspectors to make sure they do.
Do you think the smaller farms are finding it harder and harder to make a living over the years?
Yes, I do. Since the price of land is raised so much, of course, so the city property as far as that goes. But a small farm, you've got to have a certain amount of volume in order to make a living. And if a person, there's quite a few small farms, but usually they work out part-time and just maybe have them pretty much as a hobby farm and work out to get their bread and butter.
So there's less family farms then than there were at one time?
Well, there's lots of family farms, but they're bigger than they were by far. The small family farms went out, and the bigger ones kind of incorporated, took them in, bought them up. And it's all over. I heard here the other day that during the 30s, during the Depression, a third of the population lived on farms. And now it's probably 1-2% is about the size of it. I'm not sure of that percentage, but I know I said that there was about a third of the people lived on farms at that time during the.
Were you involved with any farm associations or cattle associations?
Yes, we belong to the Wheat League, and we belong to the Cattle Association. I guess it's about Farm Bureau, of course. And about it. I get to thinking back when I was in school, how much difference there was. Maybe this is turning back at.
That's okay. That doesn't matter.
Well, I was thinking here the other day how much difference there was when I was going to high school. There was a bus come around, pick us up. They'd come through Light Canyon around this way, and they'd have probably 25 or 30 kids by the time they get to uni. And I like to hunt pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So I take my shotgun and some shells and get on the bus, ride to uni, leave the shotgun on the bus, and when we come home at night, well, I'd get off over here a couple of 3 miles, and there were lots of pheasants in those days.
You still have quite a few out here, I thought.
Well, not like there was. Like you could always get your limit by the time
on the way home.
But it seems so funny. I mean, nobody thought anything about it. Take your shotgun on the bus, and that was fine. They wouldn't approve of that.
Yeah, I don't think you do that on the bus with a gun.
No.
Yeah, times have changed a lot when it comes to that.
Yes, it is.
How big was your graduating class?
Well, I think it was about 20 in it. 18, 20. Pretty small. One of the smaller ones for you.
And have you all pretty much stuck around here?
No, hardly any of them.
And it's just you, huh?
No, there's a couple, three. Marion Stetzel up here, and one in Union, and Marvin Wigglesworth, I don't know if you're familiar with him or not.
Sounds familiar.
And he was in that class.
How has the city of Union changed over the years? How has the city of Union changed over the years?
Well, they used to have a theater. The bus used to stop and feed the passengers at a restaurant in Union. About three times a day, three different buses a day. They had three or four filling stations and a couple of garages. Now they don't have a theater, they don't have a bus stop, they don't have a bus.
No, they don't.
And it has changed quite a bit. I don't think, well, there's probably a few more people live there, but in the morning, you see why, because they're all working on the ground, and this is quite a busy highway here about 8 o'clock in the morning.
What do you remember about Hot Lake?
Well, I remember a time or two in the wintertime, I'd stop there for some reason. It was always a nice, warm building. They used to have a train that stopped there, a depot.
Mm-hmm.
Passengers, before trains a day stopped there, probably more than that, but there'd usually be at least two each way, and they'd all stop there for passengers if they wanted them to. I remember when it burnt down, there was about probably as much on the west end that burnt, and as there is left there now. And they used to have lots of people there. When I was small, I heard the older people and the bigger kids talking about dances they'd have over there, you know, and there was lots of activity. Of course, it was a hospital, but there was also transportation wasn't so good. And I imagine most of the people who worked there lived there.
Mm-hmm.
In that area. And they had a dairy, and they had large chicken houses. There were two-story chicken houses, and they were heated with warm water.
Wow.
And they used to have a little slaughterhouse. We used to take the pig over there when they wanted to butcher it for the home use every once in a while. And the water was coming out of the ground. It wasn't right at the lake. It was over probably, I remember, probably a quarter of a mile east of where the building is now. And it was about an inch and a half pipe running with water, hot water, into a scalding vat. You could take your hog over there and butcher it, scald it and butcher it, and do it yourself. As long as you clean the place up, that's all I ask. But that's dried up, and they tell me, Alan Cartwright said he used to rent that place.
Mm-hmm.
And here in about 1960s or 70s, they had a big earthquake in Yellowstone Park.
Mm-hmm.
They had I remember it was quite a severe one because there was some landslides, a mountain slid off, and I think there were some people killed in it. But I think he said it was 13 days after that earthquake in Yellowstone Park, this well where the slaughterhouse was dried up completely.
Really?
And it's been running there.
Wow.
So there must have been some connection.
Some type of connection. Did they ever, what caused the fire on the west side of that hot lake building?
I have no idea.
I just always wondered.
I don't think, I've never heard that there. I know it happened in the daytime, in the afternoon, because it was quite a spectacular fire.
Sure it was.
It was 3 stories high, and it was all framed. But they used to have people come from all over the United States to bathe, and they had mud baths, and they had mineral baths, and it was just a busy place.
Well, they referred to it as the Mayo Clinic of the West, I think.
There was a Dr. Pye on this.
Mm-hmm.
And he was well thought of all over the United States, I guess. And he also had a little cabin up in Ladd Canyon. It's just about where the Ladd Canyon exits, where you exit off of Highway 84. No, right about in that spot. It was, I say a cabin, it was probably a 3-story house down on Ladd Creek. And they said when pressure would get too much, he'd just get his horse and buggy and
go hide.
Get there and stay for a day or two, and they didn't have a telephone, and that's where he got his relaxation. But he was a real well thought of doctor. And he was a good neighbor. I remember he used to, he'd buy hay for his dairy from the local people, and he was real down to earth. I don't remember him, but I remember my folks talking about him. And real down to earth started to come. No, you're talking about pheasants around here now. There used to be actually hundreds of pheasants compared to where they were now.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something else that's changed. When I was probably early in high school or maybe in junior high, Fish and Wildlife had a deal to get rid of the owls and the hawks and the crows. And they had a contest one time, for 2 or 3 years. And you could go and kill crows and hawks and owls and take their legs, and the one that had the most legs, of course, would win. Well, it was a $20 or a .22 rifle at the time. Well, there was another young fellow who lived over here on Davis, worked for Pete Richard Davis, Davis Cattle Company. His folks did. And we teamed up, and we just climbed trees, and of course, eggs was another thing. If you could get the egg to that, it's half as much as a pair of legs were, I think they called it. But the first year we did pretty good, but we didn't think we had enough, so we put them in salt and kept them the second year, and the second year we won the $20. But I think we had. And of course, at that time, they wanted you to kill hawks and owls,
mm-hmm.
because you were getting the pheasant eggs, and they still do, of course, but it's a completely different thing now. I mean, if you killed an owl, you're in bad trouble.
They frown upon that these days.
Mm-hmm, they do. But those kind of things, I get a kind of a kick out of thinking back of the things that salmon used to come up Catholic Creek by the hundreds.
Really?
Oh, yes. And of course, there was always a lot of what they call trash fish too. There was carp and suckers and bullhead catfish and all that kind of stuff. It was lots of fun for kids to catch, and lots of them. And even up until our kids were in school, where there were lots of that stuff. Lynn Union used to be on septic tanks, and they switched over, and they had a sewer, but they dumped their sewer into Catherine Creek. And now you can't even see any carp where there used to be lots of them. They don't really want to say that that's what caused it, but it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's pretty obvious. There's just no fishing, no body fishing down here mm-hmm. for anything. There is salmon going through now, few. They go up Catherine Creek to spawn, but nothing like there used to be.
What about the population of deer? Has that changed at all?
The population
of deer?
Of what?
Deer?
Deer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's well, when I was small, there was probably not as many as there is now, but 20 or 30 years ago, well, 40 years ago, there were lots of them. Well, then they had what they call their doe season, killing female deer,
mm-hmm.
and they really wiped them out pretty good back then. Well, there's quite a few deer now, but nothing like there was then either. When we first started running cattle in the hills, we'd go up fixing fence in the spring, and of course the kids would see how many deer they could count just on the open pasture up there, and they'd lots of times get 200 or 300 that they could see in a day. And it's not like that now, even in the spring. Yeah, there's lots of difference now.
I think we've covered about everything.
Oh?
Unless you can think of something else?
Well, no. Not that I can think of.
Well, if I think of anything else, I'll give you a...